liebsten Zeppelin-Motiv. Da redet er von Peter, was auch so ein paar Dorffest, den Zeppelin-Motiv gab. But there are still members that are remaining in the committee there. But also the apologies of members who are not here have arranged that alternates to join us from the provinces where the members who have tendered apologies are not here. So other members will join us as soon as that meeting is over. It was scheduled to be over by 9, but unfortunately still continuing. And it is delaying now, this meeting. But we're going to continue now, and they'll join us whilst we continue with the meeting. Just wanted to apologize that we're supposed to start at 9, but because of these delays, we are only starting now at 9:15. Let me take this opportunity to welcome all of you, particularly those who will be presenting, and also members, honorable members, and the Department of Labor, CCMA, and everybody else who's here. We'll start first with the introductions. We start with the members and the Department of Labor, parliamentary staff, and the presenters and everybody else. My name is Mandla Chai. Chai is spelled R-A-Y-I. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development. It's a committee that oversight six departments. Department of Labor is one of the six departments. I'll allow honorable members to introduce themselves. Whoever is ready to start.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Honorable Zwane, representing KwaZulu-Natal in the National Council of Provinces. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Vusi Magwebu. I represent the people of the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Willem Faber, and I represent the Northern Cape Province in the NCOP.
DDG.
Good morning, I'm not sure what you need to do. I'm the Deputy Secretary.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ludo Musishu. I'm the content advisor for the committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mr. Rasmus from Parliament.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Fatima Ibrahim, Parliamentary Legal Advisor. I have with me a grade 11 student that is job shadowing us today as well.
Morning, everyone. My name is Bongile Maputi. I'm a media officer assigned to the committee.
Can we come to you first, if you can introduce yourselves?
Good morning, Chair, and your colleagues, and honourable members of Parliament, and everybody else. My name is Temba Noluchungu. I am from the Free Market Foundation. Next to me is my colleague from the Free Market Foundation, fellow director. His name is Eustace Davy. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of this committee. My name is Jeff Jacobs, and I'm representing the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
My name is Chris Lopesha from the private security sector, represented from SASA, the South African Security Association.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Dr. Shane Godfrey from the Labour and Enterprise Policy Research Group at University of Cape Town.
Good morning, Chair. Mohamed Likweta from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Beonia Khurubum from the Chief State Law Advisor.
Morning, Chair. My name is Mandla Mbusi, representing Business Unity South Africa. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Marco Schmidt from the German Consulate General.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Honorable. I mean, if you can introduce yourself, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Kathy Dlamini, member of the NCOP.
Thank you very much.
Let's start now. We start with our presentations. We start with the Free Market Foundations. I don't know who's going to start between the two of you. Okay, Mr. Is it Noluchungu?
Noluchungu, yes.
Oh, it's written, it's not written correctly in my program.
Oh, my Chungu. Word.
Oh, Noluchungu, okay.
Yeah, Noluchungu.
All right.
Thank you, Chair, for this opportunity that we've been afforded for us to articulate the Free Market Foundation's viewpoint on generally on an issue that we think is the most burning issue that confronts this country, which is the fact that we have an unemployment situation which is nothing short of a cataclysm, unemployment situation where we have more than 45% of our fellow South Africans not being employed, upwards of 45%. And so for us, our input is focused primarily, if not exclusively, on just this point. This statistic is a very important one, the fact of the 45% of not being employed in this country, because it has very serious implications, socioeconomic implications. It has crime implications, and this occurs at the time when in the first quarter of this year we have a situation where the economy is shrinking, has shrunk by 2.2%. So that gives a context in terms of our presentation. We have made earlier submissions on the various bills that are under discussion, but we decided in addition to that, in terms of our current presentation, that we should focus on the one that's just been disseminated. I just hope people will have a copy of the current one that's been put out. Or if not, they can look at it later on. We believe that with all these bills that are under consideration, that they miss out on something that's crucially, crucially important. And this is the fact that we have so many unemployed people. None of these bills, from what we have studied so far, addresses the question of the unemployed people. And so, our focus is on that point. Our evidence today, we will not go into the details of the whole quartet of the bills. three of which consist of amendments to existing labor acts that are being revised to support the National Minimum Wage Bill, on which we have already made a detailed submission sometime last year and currently and continue to do so by commenting on that. But we ask the question, and this is a question that we prevail on ministers to ask themselves, what about the unemployed? We are here to ask a crucial question, which is, what about the unemployed? Not only the 9.48 million people who are currently unemployed, but also the estimated 715,000 as acknowledged by Treasury and the President who will potentially become unemployed because of the adoption and implementation of the National Minimum Wage Bill. Is South Africa going to set a record of 10 million unemployed and more than 40%? That will be 400 out of every 1,000 people of the potential workforce unemployed. It is very worrying that so much time is being devoted to the lot of low-income employees while nothing meaningful is being done about the masses, the numbers, the frightening numbers of unemployed people. And these are the people in zero, do not anything whatsoever. They are not able to put bread on the table to provide for their families, and they lose self-respect in the process. We are aware that there are some commentators who maintain that the job losses will be minimal, but the Treasury, ourselves and others, we think otherwise. The President, in a written response this past Friday to a question to Parliament, said that the job losses can be avoided if the businesses apply for an exemption. He had said, and I quote him, the mitigation of job losses that may result from the introduction of the national minimum wage is the collective responsibility of government, business and labor. It appears from the statement that the President shares our concerns. He is not brushing aside the issue of further job losses. He acknowledges it, which is of such great concern to us and should be to all people. However, there is a fatal error in the implementation of the exemption as conceptualized. At the regulation stage, the Department of Labor intends to introduce extensive bureaucratic demands and to turn the so-called exemption into a 10% reduction. And even that minimal reduction is to be granted to the discretion, at its discretion. Does the Parliament know this? The main purpose of the quartet of legislation that is being dealt with today is to increase the job security and earnings of the people who already have jobs. We have no problem with that whatsoever. There is almost no mention, this is our concern, no mention of the unemployed in the four documents. There is no mention of the impact that the introduction of the national minimum wage, which will significantly raise the barrier to employment, will have on the 9.48 million currently unemployed people. If they have been unable to find jobs at 2,000 rands per month, what chance will they have of getting a job at 3,500 rands a month? This statement is very, very axiomatic. It is self-evident. It's almost a rhetorical question. What this package of legislation does is, one, give higher incomes to the low-income employed who manage to keep their jobs. Two, jeopardize the jobs of the estimated 715,000 whose jobs will be at risk. Three, make it even more difficult for the 9.48 million unemployed to get jobs, cutting their legs from underneath them. What will the potential 10 million jobless do to vent their frustration and despair? Make In this regard, I can just mention that in Tunisia, which had a much lower unemployment rate, an incident just sparked off a spontaneous uprising. I'm not saying this is what I predict, but the thing is, desperate people, that means unemployed people, over the long term, they can be receptive to or tend to contemplate desperate things, with some of them bordering on more criminal sort of margin. We suggest that we make the exemption from the national minimum wage a real exemption. Commentators on the national minimum wage bill have given the media and the general public the misleading impression that the word exemption has its ordinary dictionary meaning. This would mean that individual and small firm employers who are granted an exemption will be given total exemption from the application of the National Minimum Wage Act. The reality is totally different. For example, the owner of a small spaza shop, say in Khayelitsha, Pontyhivo, or Mpumalanga Township, with three young employees who she pays 1,500 rand per month, will discover that the new system will require her financial information, household income, a commercial balance sheet, working hours, and a motivation, which after thorough audit will determine the granting or rejection of a request for what is called an exemption, but is certainly not. The sting in the tail, though, is that going to all that trouble, she will be allowed to pay her young employees a minimum of 18 rands per hour or 3,150 rands per month, a 10% reduction, that is, but an increase of 110% on her wage bill. The stroke of the regulatory pen will destroy the jobs of three young people, in this case, in this scenario as depicted, and probably force the owner to close her shop. And that scenario will play out throughout the country. We appeal to the members of the Select Committee to introduce economic sanity into this scenario. Sorry for using strong words, but I can't be less dramatic than this because of the nature of the challenge that confronts us in terms of as related to the unemployment cataclysm that confronts us in this country. Intercede, we urge, on behalf of the employees and the individuals, the small firms that employ them, propose a real exemption to be incorporated in the regulations of the people across the country that are in the kind of situation as described. And don't make them apply for exemption. Write into the regulations, for instance, an automatic exemption for people employing less than a certain number of people and having less and having less than a specified turnover. Such an approach would enormously reduce administrative costs and avoid the misery that will be caused to small firm owners. If a real exemption is not introduced, it is surely not the intention of government to fool the people by misusing the word exemption. But then again, I would like to make an apology, but I'm tempted not to because of the nature of the problem that confronts us in this country. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown, and that's you, members of parliament, policymakers, legislators. Why is there no panic, we ask ourselves, about the unemployment crisis? How is it that the focus is on the low-income workers who have jobs and not on our mass employed people? Why has an urgent commission of inquiry not been appointed to determine why such a huge percentage of the potential workforce of the country is unemployed, and to find ways and means of increasing the real demand for labor, which is the only way to permanently reduce the level of unemployment? We want unemployed people to be part of the wealth creation process, to participate productively in the economy, we want them to be part of a situation in the economy whereby they play their part in terms of generating jobs for other people. That's where we stand on this. There's a saying in the Bible, and I hope this is not going to come across as being blasphemous, but I was tempted to include this. And those people amongst us who might be atheistic or something, or might find this problematic being articulated from a Christian point of view. The Bible saying says, to describe the policy that is being followed in the labor market, and I quote, to whom shall be given, and he shall have more abundance, but whomever has not, from him shall be taken away even that which he has. This is Matthew 13. I'm not a pastor, but I was quite much inclined to page through some pages of the Bible and other religious documents that are not part of the Christian sort of worship scenario. In the socioeconomic impact assessment, this is a point that we also bring to your attention, that is prepared by the Department of Labor, which is attached to the National Minimum Wage Bill. Four affected parties were mentioned: government, business, organized labor, and civil society. There is no mention of the unemployed, who are the most affected parties. Is the omission of the unemployed from the list of affected parties an indication that they really do not count, that the employment issue is to be ignored? Sometimes when one, you know, presents statistics, they tend to people who, when listening to the presentation of statistics, they tend to sometimes forget that it is individual human beings that we're talking about. And this reminds me of what Stalin had said quite a while ago when he was asked a question. He had said, the death of one individual is a tragedy. The deaths of millions is a statistics. So please, we prevail on members of parliament that when we think statistically in terms of the percentage of people who are unemployed, that we think in terms of individual human beings who are affected individually and also in the context of their households. And the national minimum wage is a huge new barrier to entry into the job market, a barrier that will prevent many of the 9.48 million currently unemployed people from getting jobs. The message to the unemployed is, we are making it. This is a message that they would be reading if they were acquainted with what is happening in terms of the various bills that are put together. We are making it illegal for employers to employ you for less than 20 rands per hour or 3,500 rands per month. Those of you who could have found jobs for 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 per month, sorry, but those wages will in future be illegal. You say you are prepared to work for less, to learn skills, build up in the process a work record, put bread on the table, take yourselves off the streets, get your pride back. Sorry, jobs like that have been made illegal to protect you from yourself. You see, there are people who know better than what is good for you. The national minimum wage legislation would have had the effect, same effect, if the penalties were imposed on the worker and not on the employer. In other words, if you dare to work for less than 20 rands per hour or 3,500 per month, you will be punished. Perhaps a prison sentence could be considered, which would replace an illegal low-paid job with free food and accommodation. Chair, this might sound crass and even bitter. I do not apologize. Let me be to some degree apologize for speaking so harshly, but the message is still a cold one that I have to articulate. I'm haunted personally by the fact that yet another veritable nail in the coffin of the unemployed is being created. I know that there will be those who will claim that they are the ones who really care, who berate employers for not paying higher wages. but want to use force to achieve their objective, my response to them is, it is you who are leaving a trail of destruction and misery for millions of individuals and households behind you. I don't know how you can sleep at night. I have to impress this. Chair, at this point, I'm handing over the reins to my colleague who will do the last bit of his presentation, and then we'll field questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nolich. But let me remind you that for the presentation now, it's you only have 10 minutes. So altogether, we give a stakeholder 30 minutes. So you already taken 20 minutes. So you left with 10 minutes to conclude.
Thank you, Chairperson. One of the serious difficulties that we have is where they have a national minimum wage that applies to the whole country, where we know that in the cities the wages are much higher than out in the country areas. So there's an imbalance in wages, but a same minimum wage to apply to everyone. Now, we have an example where this happens in the United States. The United States areas, the territories of Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and the Northern Mariana Islands, the disastrous consequences for those areas when they were compelled to apply the same minimum wage as mainland United States. This was brought in what a piece of legislation called Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2007. Now, in American Samoa, the minimum wage is moved from $5.15 to $7.25. They had to increase to that figure by 2019. The GDP per capita fell nearly 10% from 2006 levels by 2009. In Northern Mariana Islands, by the end of 2009, employment was down by 35% and the GDP down by 23%. In Puerto Rico, the minimum wage, as it was introduced, was 75% of the median wage. Unemployment increased rapidly and GDP per capita declined by 7% between 2007 and 2013. Those territories were actually, they were decimated by that situation. Then another problem we have is that the unemployed people are prevented by the labor laws of the situation from accessing jobs. And just a few sections of the Bill of Rights. It enshrines the right of all people of our country and affirms the democratic values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. The unemployed do not enjoy that right. It requires the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights of the Bill of Rights. They do not have their rights respected. It provides that the state may not unfairly discriminate, directly or indirectly, against anyone on one or more grounds, not intentionally, but the labor laws and this minimum wage will just to discriminate unfairly against them. And everyone has the right to dignity and the right to have their dignity respected. Now, we don't want to sound totally negative, so we have come up with a proposal to be considered. It is true that we are convinced that the implementation of the national minimum wage is set to have extensive negative consequences, particularly for the 9.48 million people who are already unemployed. For the sake of the people of South Africa, we wish to propose a workable solution that will help to rapidly reduce unemployment. The crux of the proposal is for the unemployed people to be given job seekers exemptions to give them control over their own working lives. We are aware that a political party has adopted our proposal, which was set out in the booklet Jobs for the Doctors. We published it in 2003. That was the genesis of this idea. We are totally nonpartisan and sincerely hope that for the sake of the unemployed, political competition will not prevent other parties from supporting a proposal that will allow unemployed people to access jobs without affecting the job security of people who are already employed. The essentials of the proposal are: one, people who have been unemployed for 6 months or longer should automatically qualify for certificates. A simple and quick procedure should be adopted for issuing certificates, like for a post office and a municipal licensing centre. The exemption should cover all the labour laws that currently prevent employment from taking place. Employers of exempted employees must be protected in respect of those employees only from the provisions of any legislation from which the employees have been exempted. The JSEX should be valid for at least 2 years to allow the holders to change jobs freely until they find jobs that suit them best. Basic, simple, written employment contracts between JSEC holders and employers should be obligatory to ensure that there is no doubt as to the basis of their agreements. This is the bare bones of the proposal. We would be happy to supply more detailed information to anyone who is interested. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the input. We will now allow members to ask questions, and you can note the questions, and then I'll give you time to respond to the questions. Members, Honorable Faba, Honorable Makwebu, for now, Honorable Zwane, and Honorable Shamini. Thank you. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the Free Market Foundation for your presentation. I think from my side, I do know where you come from, that unemployment is the big problem that we actually have. And I do understand if this minimum wage bill goes through, that obviously it can actually cause big job losses as well. For me at this situation, we're sitting in a catch-22 situation here, because on the one side, we want workers to be protected. There are certain type of regulations that myself would think can work in certain sectors, but it also makes it difficult for unemployed people to get employment, especially with the wages of 20 rand minimum that was proposed to us. I would like to know if there are proposals that you've got to actually protect workers, right? I understand that you're saying that there's 10 million people unemployed, and we are almost more concerned than you as politicians, because work is the most important thing for any South African, to have the right to be able to have a work, and we don't want to take that right away. We would actually encourage everyone to find a job. But what alternatives do you have on the table to actually protect those that do have work and that do get exploited by people on wages? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Makwebu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Nulisungu, thank you for your presentation, but quickly, let's do this. I want you to help me understand where do you stand. Are you opposed to the minimum wage or not? I'm asking this question because I am struggling to see where you stand. I understand the issues of unemployment. Indeed, there are issues we are all alive to and we are all worried about, but so much is being done to, you know, to deal with that, given all the challenges we're facing as a country. But be that as it may, the minimum wage as it is tabled, when I read in a document, you seem to suggest that you are not happy with it in its current form. Is that my correct reading? Or are you completely opposed to it? That's my first question. Secondly, let's go to page 2 of your presentation. And I want to quote you on the 1, 2, 3, let's call it a third paragraph. The main purpose of the quartet of the legislation is that it is being dealt with, The main purpose of the quartet of legislation that is being dealt with today is to increase the job security and earnings of the people who already have jobs. Do you have a problem with that? Are you saying that people must be exploited? Because if you agree that the spirit and the purport is to increase the earnings and give them jobs, increase the earnings of those people who are already employed, so it means obviously this should be something that must be welcomed. Perhaps what we should be debatable is how do we do that? Because if you look at your presentation again, you are looking at exemptions and you say there's a fatal error in the implementation of the exemptions, and you come with some proposal that perhaps it must be factored in the regulations that X company who employs X amount of people with an X turnover must be given an automatic, what you call an automatic exemption. So again, hence I find this contradiction that or hence I ask this question rather, are you opposed to the minimum wage completely, or are you saying in its current form, because you seem to argue that it must be done in a different way, as you suggested, automatic exemptions. So I want you to come up clearly if you're opposed to that. Because you see, we'll have a problem if you are opposed to that. South Africa is a signatory to, you know, the many conventions, the ILO convention that deals with the issue of minimum wage. And if you look back to that, this has been an issue that is all over the world, has been an issue that needed to be addressed. Way back in 1919, there's been progressive, you know, debates around this issue. So South Africa, being a signatory to that, it should be welcomed as a progressive move. But perhaps the question would be the how part of it. How do we do that? And I would want you to respond from this comment I've just made. And lastly, you have countries that you have mentioned from your presentation. When I say you, I'm saying jointly with the colleague next to you. Countries you have mentioned where the GDP went down when the minimum wage was increased, and where there was unemployment where the minimum wage was increased. Then again, and be that as it may, what are you suggesting? Are you opposed to the minimum wage, or are you saying if the minimum wage, you know, is implemented, it must be done in a responsible manner that we do not lose jobs, and perhaps in doing that, your suggestions must be considered that there must be automatic exemptions with the particular turnover, X amount of employees, and what have you. But the minimum wage is the elephant in the room that we must embrace and accept that we are at that stage in the country where we have to deal with. I want you to come clearly on that score as the Free Market Foundation, because I think it is important for us to know where you stand. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Zane.
Thank you, Chairperson, Honourable Members, and different organizations that have come to present. Good morning. I do want to comment on this presentation by the Free Market Foundation. We do welcome the presentation. A lot of thought has been put to it. But we need to look at the realities of the economic climate of South Africa and the predicament that we're facing as a country of the rising standard of living. Petrol price went up just a couple of weeks ago, raising the tickets for the commuters to get to work, making it difficult to secure grocery because the price of food, once petrol rises, then every other thing, the price of every other commodity will rise. We are sitting with a situation where we need to look at statistics. We are really sympathetic to those people that are not employed, believe you me. No government would enjoy a situation where an increasing number of people are not employed. That is not the intention of the act. Nonetheless, we need to look at that against the number of those that are employed and are suffering low wages within the employment itself. And we've got to take hard decisions as to say, given the rising cost of living, we need to protect our own workforce from exploitation by the different industrial houses. I don't know what your proposal is, whether you are saying, you make me understand. We need to categorize people. There are those that are going to be receiving the minimum wage as prescribed, 3,500. And it is law. Employers will have to pay that for them in terms of the law. And there are those that are going to work as some kind of volunteers where they are going to be accepting an amount of money that will be an agreement between themselves and the employer, and they fall outside of the category of these that are supposed to be getting a wage of 3,500 as prescribed by the law. I see clarity on that one. Are you proposing different categories of people to be treated differently, not to be covered by the same law of the country? I am also a Christian, and I did take note of the fact that you are quoting the Bible here and there, but I want to believe that the Father that we worship in our kingdom is God everything, and he wants us to be prosperous. He does not want us to live on a pittance. He wants us to be wealthy. He wants us to be participants in the wealth of the country. He wants us to earn a good wage and live well. That is the God that we worship. So the fact that you are quoting the Bible as to say those that have will have more and those that don't have, the little will be taken away from them. Yes, it is a biblical verse, but I want to argue and say that the God that we worship wants us to live as kings and queens, because he's got everything. All we need to do is to find a formula as to how to address these issues, because our government is really doing all that we can to ensure that we increase the scope of employment and people begin to live in a manner that is dignified. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mamsa. Honorable Shamis.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. My greetings to honorable members and organizations that are going to be presenting here. I just want to start with the verse from the Bible. I've been touched by that verse. Just one issue there. Yes, I am a Christian, not only a Christian, a born again. Just one issue there. You see, if you quote one verse in the Bible, it could be misleading without a context where it comes from. You just quote one verse to suit what you are presenting. Those who don't know the background of the verse, why was that verse in there? Where does it come from? It could be misinterpreted. I usually don't like that. I do want people to get the context of which the verse was written so that they have a clear picture of what was meant about a particular verse. I'm very much jealousy about Christianity because I'm into it full time. Chairperson, the first question is that I'm not sure whether you are opposing the minimum wage or not. I would want to hear you clearly saying you are opposing it, so that we, instead of talking about the unemployed, because you see here, once you talk about a wage, you're talking about people who are employed or are going to be employed. I've been covered by my colleagues in terms of protection. In fact, there was a loud voice from those who were earning less, exploited, to say, please, government, protect us.
I think this is the response now from the government in protecting them. I want to know, these inputs, for me, Chairperson, the manner in which this input is being presented is like this is the only bill we have in the country, forgetting that there are other programs. When you say discriminating the unemployed, it's like there is no other thing that is being done by government to address the unemployed. There are a number of programs the government is doing. Cannot employ everyone at the same time. If I can mention the few, you have the NYDA, there's a program there aiming to assist those who are not employed. It's not the question of them being employed, but also participating in business. If we look at the empowering of our people through employment only, I think we'll be missing the point. It's not everyone who wants to work. Those who could be in business, they can't be in business. Then the second matter, you also have NDA, National Development Agency. You have your small business, a number of programs that are there, aiming to support those who are unemployed, your EPWP, with the loopholes that it has, your CWP. Those programs are aimed to support the unemployed. So you shouldn't be looking at this bill as the only bill that is there in government. My question on that, Chair, is that do you want us to include the unemployed on this minimum wage bill, or are you just raising issue to initiate a process that will deal with the unemployed? Because I also heard you talking about the commission that will be looking into that. Do you want two separate processes, or you want this to be included here? Because if you include this one here, you may as well have to consider the name of the bill itself, because the minimum wage only applies to people who are employed. Chairperson, the third matter for me, I'm surprised to hear a person who is saying there are people who are prepared to work for 20 rand per hour, 1,000 per month, 2,000, and you feel that those people are discriminated. In my experience from the communities, I saw you written Mpumalanga Township. I'm sure you're meaning Mpumalanga KZN, not my province. In my province, Mpumalanga, no one will be prepared to work for this money. No one. No one prepared to work for this money unless if they are forced by conditions. Because the way you have put it, that is on page 4, the top paragraph there. You are saying that people who are prepared to work for that money. I don't think there is no person in the right mind will be prepared to work for this money. What came to my mind was that, Chair, I wonder what would you say during the apartheid regime, even still now, where farmers, where people were working and were paid with a bag of millet. Will you consider those people employed and prepared to take that? And if they are not protected in terms of the minimum wage, we feel that they are discriminated. I don't think there is such a person who's willing. Chairperson, the last one is that I just want to know that he wants us to put these things of unemployment people in this bill, or he's trying to provoke a process of another in a process for people who are unemployed. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to check if the other members would like to pose questions, because we're not going to have a second round. Covered. Okay. Now, I just want from my side to check, perhaps if you can respond to the comments I'm going to be making, that the aim of the national minimum wage is to ensure structural change in the labor market, that's one, and two, that it aims to address the persistence of poverty and inequality. But also, there's a sex in your presentation, the heading on the talking about there's no panic on unemployed, but some of my colleagues have addressed that there are programs in government generally. In fact, also if you were to go to the annual performance plan of the Department of Labor, you see that the department is doing something about unemployment. There are programs that are focusing on that. But I just want to quote what you're saying under the heading, why is there no panic about unemployment crisis? How is it that the focus is on low-income workers who have jobs and not our mass unemployed? I mean, also, you could be asked a question, why are you, for example, in a statement, I want you to comment in a statement that says, the highest earning 10% on average and 82 times the lowest earning 10%, while the wealthiest 10% owned 90 to 95% of the country's assets. So you're not saying about those who are earning high salaries up there, the executives. You're not saying that they are also causing unemployment. You're saying that those who are at the lower end are the ones that are causing unemployment if their rate is pushed up to 20 rand. But you have people that are earning 10 million annually. You're not saying anything about that as a free market foundation. But coming to the issue of, in fact, in your own view, what is the minimum living level? Because there are studies that have been conducted. Have you ever conducted a study on minimum level, minimum living level? Have you conducted such a study? And what are the results of your study? You know, for a person to at least be able to provide the most basic necessities for their families, if you can also respond on that. But also on the issue of the exemption. You say that there must be automatic exemption. What's your problem with the with the proposals that are in the bill on how to deal with the exemptions? And also, what is your experience? Because it's not the first time that we're going to have exemption. Exemptions are already there in law for even other sectors. What has been your experience with the exemptions that are currently in law? But also, you talk about this automatic exemption that must take into account the turnover, but also it must take into account the number of employees. I mean, if you could have that in a law, and you mean that then from time to time the law must be changed if then the turnover is more, so that law must now be changed. Because if you say in a law specifically, for example, please 100,000. So if in 2 years' time that 100,000 is very little, so now we must make new amendments to accommodate that particular level. Okay, if you can respond to questions.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by relating a story. I'm going to be as brief as possible, and then I'll respond to...
I forgot to tell you also that we have pastors here. One of them was the General Secretary of South African Council of Churches. So we must be careful when it comes to Bible.
Yeah, thanks for warning me about that. At some point I was feeling rather being religiously intimidated. And I have stated up front that I'm not a pastor, but I just encountered this passage from the Bible, and I thought it's appropriate for me to incorporate this into the presentation. But let me give a context to some of the questions that I'll be dealing with, and my colleague will respond to some, to the others. There's a man in Langa, where I live, a neighbor, who was, I think, 5, 6, 7 years older than me, and he was out of work. And he always would come to my place and say, Temba, please get me a job, any job out there. I don't care what I have to do. I don't care what the conditions are. I want to move away from this situation where I've been unemployed for so long, and where I see my wife going off to work, she comes home. Can you imagine what that does to me as a man who's supposed to be providing for the family? He was talking about self-respect. And every time, on a regular basis, this man would come up to me, sometimes seeing me coming home, and say, Temba, anything. At some point, he would just make this gesture, like, any signifying anything available, and I'll say to him, sorry, nothing. And he died in miserable circumstances in terms of him feeling that at some point in life that he could not provide for his family. So what was Mr. Bagnulo saying? He died a while ago, just a couple of years ago. What was he saying? He was saying, I don't care what the conditions might be. I just want to end something. And what he was saying, it can be expressed, encapsulated in the words of some economist who later was under political pressure, decided to support the national minimum wage. What, I think that was Joan Robbins, the economist, she had said, what is worse than being exploited by capitalists is not being exploited. Basically, what this means is, for a person to be able to put bread on the table, that's much better than just folding one's arms and not doing anything. Because when you're unemployed, especially over a long period of time, your self-respect, your self-esteem suffers, and you're desperate, and you just languish in this, you fall into this abyss of misery. And this sometimes drives people to become unsociable. So in the context of marriage, for example, here's a wife who works, here's a man who doesn't work. And the wife, at some point, the man says, oh, you're cheeky now because you are the one who brings income into their household. And, you know, so you kept all those kinds of problems.
Chair, with your respect, may I raise a point of order? We press with time. Mm. And
okay.
We've got a program, we must finish it too. Can you just respond to the question you said?
Yeah.
I appreciate your passion, but the stories aren't going to help us, with your respect, Chair.
Can you go
okay,
back,
thank you, Chair. I've got
the
message, but the stories do illustrate a moral. There is a moral in some of these stories. But anyway, I accept the member's concern. But the point is, let's talk about the national minimum wage. National minimum wage, we are nailing the colors of the Free Market Foundation to the mast. We are opposed to it. We are opposed to it for some of these basic reasons, and that is when you have, and we are backed by empirical evidence, where a minimum wage has been implemented, the people who are first to lose their jobs and the last to be hired are people who have no skills, who are unskilled, people who don't have work experience, and these people, such people in this category, tend to be young people. That's the basic reason, one of the reasons why we are opposed to it. But you are frank, we're nailing the colors to the mast, and that's the point. Let me deal with another point that's been raised here, seeing that we've been reminded that we are pressed for time. Now, the job seekers exemption certificates, its point of departure is that the assumption is that everything is left intact. So all the amendments are passed, they are enacted, they become law, which is mandatory, which is implemented. But the point of departure is, in terms of the job seeker's exemption certificate, is don't interfere with it. Focused on the unemployed, you say this is what applies only to the unemployed people, as has been described by my colleague here next to me. That is what this is about. So we assume that at the end of the day, finally, with all these proposed bills adopted at the end of the day, that is fine, but focus on the unemployed people and allow for flexibility so that they can be employed, because, say, low-skilled jobs where there are also low wages are the first point of entry for people who are especially unskilled and not commanding high, sophisticated levels of education. Is their first point of entry into the labor market. Eustace, you want to deal with other questions? Then I'll come back to deal with the others. I don't want to miss anything.
Chair, the most important part of what we're proposing is this, that we understand what government is trying to do. But in the process, people are being prevented from getting jobs, people are going to lose jobs. So what's proposed in this little book is leave the people who have jobs, are employed, leave the labour laws intact. Don't touch them. But give the unemployed people the right to make the decisions about their own lives. Let them decide for themselves what kind of job, what level of wage they are prepared to accept. Give them exemption from the labour laws for a period of suggested 2 years so that they can go and find jobs for themselves. Give them that right. Don't block them from getting employment themselves.
Yep, there's the issue. There's also the issue of inequality that crops up from time to time in other parliamentary discussion contexts. It would take us a whole day for us to debate around that. But the point is that I can make that relates to this is that we are all individuals. We are all differently endowed in terms of our talents, which might be in physical terms, and somebody is an artist that commands that talent. Somebody has intellectual capital that they can use to set up a business and hang in there and persevere until it thrives, and then it generates a lot of income, people get employed, and wealth is created, and so on. We're all differently endowed. And so when you look at the incomes that people command in whatever sphere of human endeavor, be it a sporting activity where you find Lionel Messi commanding millions of dollars, you know, much more than maybe all the fans that he normally attend matches where he plays. And like Muhammad Ali, who beat up people and in the process earning millions. And so he was talented, used his talents. I'm not a boxer. He was a boxer. Many people are not boxers. And other people who are musicians, who compose music and in the process generate substantial incomes for themselves. So we are all differently endowed. I just wanted to make that point, and we can't debate this very, very extensively because it would take a long time. But the point is, it's very important that we always remember something that's very, very important fundamentally in terms of human nature. We're different. We're differently endowed. We are. And that manifests itself in the incomes that accrue to ourselves as individuals when we embark in terms of the careers in which we are gifted or talented or work hard in. That's the one point. Now, in terms of, there's another point that's been raised. I'm going to be quick on this one. And that is in terms of having to comply with the international conventions. It's a pity most, the genesis of all these conventions is that they come from prosperous countries that are well established, that are prosperous economically. We're an emerging country. We're an emerging economy. And so I'm not saying that we should lock horns with people who are proponents of these international conventions, but they should be made aware that by virtue of the fact that we are a developing economy, we have challenges that we have to focus on. And those countries, whatever policies they might implement, to some degree they can absorb whatever negative consequences might emanate from that for a while, but in the long term then the chickens come home to roost. But with us, because we are a labor-intensive economy, we need to focus on what is supposed to be our great strength. That is the market that is there, that is available, to make it possible for people to come in, to be part of the wealth creation, job creation process. Yes.
Thank you very much. I think we need to stop it there. Because we're really pressed with time. We need to get to the next presentation. But what I can assure you that the views that you have expressed, and the input that is in our package will be considered when we deliberate as a committee on your input. Thank you very much for coming. Okay. All right. Oh, thank you very much. Our next presentation now is from the Labour and Enterprise Policy Research Group, University of Cape Town, Dr. Shane Godfrey. Members, I hope that you have copies because there's not going to be a PowerPoint presentation. So, yeah. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation. The Labour and Enterprise Policy Research Group has conducted socio-legal policy-oriented research on a wide range of issues in the field of labour market regulation and development for over 25 years. Last year, we engaged in a study of the proposed national minimum wage, specifically looking at how the national minimum wage would be located within the existing labour legislation and what would need to change to accommodate it to allow it to achieve its goals most effectively. We made submissions to the Department of Labour on the National Minimum Wage Bills, the amendment to the BCA, and we also made submissions to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee for Labour at the National Assembly. In this submission to the National Council of Provinces, we're focusing on issues that we've commented on previously, but we believe are still not being addressed in the current bills, or have been inadequately addressed in the current bills. First, a general point just about the memorandum of objectives to the three bills. Previously, memorandum of objectives have given some explanation of the provisions in bills, what the thinking was behind them, what the intention is of those provisions, what they want to achieve. This is not the case with the current bills. The current bills provide almost no explanation. They simply state what, in sort of plainer language, what is in the bills themselves. So we don't believe they serve any purposes. In some cases, they cause confusion. So first, looking at the National Minimum Wage Bill, the issue of definitions of ordinary hours of work and the wage in Section 1 of the National Minimum Wage Bill, read with the definition of worker, which is a new definition in our labour legislation, a wider definition of than employee. We believe that the definitions of ordinary hours of work and age do not easily accommodate the wide expanded definition of worker. Work, in terms of the new definition of worker, could be a one-off job. There's no notion of ordinary hours of work. It could be two jobs 2 months apart, different lengths of time, 6 hours on one day, 4 hours on the other day. So the old notion of ordinary hours of work doesn't apply. So we think those definitions need to be amended to accommodate a much more irregular notion of work as provided in the new definition of worker. Section 4.48, the exclusion of the right to strike if there's a unilateral alteration of terms and conditions of employment. Section 4.8 is problematic for two reasons. First, making the unilateral altering of wages, hours of work, and other conditions of employment in relation to the introduction of the national minimum wage and unfair labour practice removes the right to strike in such a situation. Section 64.4 of the LRA specifically provides for employees to pursue strike action over an employer's unilateral altering of conditions of employment. So there's conflict between these two sections, and the current Section 4.8 excludes that Section 64.4 option of the LRA. So we believe that the amendment should be drafted to allow for trade unions or workers to utilize that option either going the strike route or going an unfair labour practice route to the CCMA or a bargaining council. The second problem we have with 4.8 is sections 191, 193, 194, 4 and 195 of the LRA provide that bargaining councils may hear unfair labour practice disputes within their jurisdiction. And they have the same jurisdiction in respect of section 64.4 disputes, which we've just discussed. However, this is at odds with the amended section 64.1D of the BCEA, which grants the CCMA exclusive jurisdiction to hear disputes regarding non-compliance with the National Minimum Wage Act. Okay? So this is a number of points where you've got this effectively bargaining councils being excluded from having a role with regard to compliance and with regard to disputes about the National Minimum Wage in favor of the CCMA. So this is the first, but I'll make a number of points further on. Section 4.9 and Section 5 of the National Minimum Wage Bill permitted and impermissible deductions from the National Minimum Wage. We believe that these sections could create confusion and that therefore it should be made clear through the addition of Section 34A of the BCEA to the list of sections referred to in Section 4.9 or to Section 5. Okay, that and those sections apply. Section 34A applies to the payment of contributions to benefit funds. At the moment, it's unclear whether a payment of a contribution to a benefit fund is a deduction from the National Minimum Wage. We think it should be a deduction. In other words, it should be included in the National Minimum Wage, but it's unclear at the moment. And we think it can be easily clarified simply by introducing 34A into that list of sections in Section 4.9. The annual review, Section 6, the annual review of the National Minimum Wage, we envisage that a problem is likely to arise but with the coordination of bargaining council increases and bargaining and the review and increase of the National Minimum Wage on an annual basis. Particularly where these are bargaining councils or sectoral determinations where the bottom wage is going to also be the bottom wage of a bargaining council agreement. So at the moment it's unclear when the National Minimum Wage is going to be implemented, but let's say it's from the 1st of August. It means that bargaining councils could negotiate an increase from the 1st of January that is going to be amended by the National Minimum Wage increase on the 1st of August. Now that is going to, we believe, undermine bargaining council arrangements and undermine a delicate balance that might have been achieved in bargaining at a bargaining council. And a similar thing, so there needs to be coordination between when that National Minimum Wage review and increase is going to take place, so bargaining councils and sectoral determinations can take that into account in the sorts in when they increase wages. We've seen it now with the increase in the wage for the hospitality sectoral determination, which has just been published, which has increased wages by 6%, but the lowest wage is still below the National Minimum Wage of 20 Rand an hour. So that wage of increase in the hospitality SD is going to automatically be increased by the National Minimum Wage. Now that on its own is not a problem, but it needs to be coordination between those two different increases. Okay, still with the National Minimum Wage Bill, Section 11C and E, which is about achieving proportionate, these are powers to the National Minimum Wage Commission and refer to achieving a proportionate income differentials. We welcome the inclusion of these subsections in the bill. However, as the section currently reads, the purpose of the inclusion, which is respond to the requirements of Section 27 of the Employment Equity Act, is not evident. The National Minimum Wage on its own will have little impact on reducing income differentials. It's going to push up the bottom wage. It might affect some of the lower ranked wages or occupational levels. It's not going to lead to comprehensive compression of wage schedules from the top, from the bottom up through to the top. So those subsections only make sense when read with Section 27 of the Employment Equity Act. Currently, Section 27 of the Employment Equity Act isn't being implemented by the Department of Labor and is being interpreted incorrectly by the Department of Labor. So there's no attention being given to reducing disproportionate income differentials as required by Section 27. So we in the full report that we've done on our research in last year, we've provided copies that goes into much more length on what needs to be done to Section 27. However, in Section 11, C and E have made the necessary changes on the side of the National Minimum Wage Bill. Looking at sectoral determination, Section 11F.
Just before you move on, you're referring to another act. So in respect of the National Minimum Wage, what proposal would you make in the bill itself?
Nothing in the bill itself. The bill has done as much as it can do.
Okay.
Our argument is that it's not going to achieve very much unless one looks at the Employment Equity Act and the problems with Section 27.
Okay.
And Employment Equity Act. Sectoral determinations were proposed from the by the Department of Labor to be dropped. Okay, there weren't going to be sectoral determinations anymore. And after a lot of pressure, the Department of Labor has reintroduced sectoral determinations. But it's now very much dependent on the Minister of Labor as to how effectively sectoral determinations are going to work, how regularly they're going to be reviewed, whether they're going to be adjusted, whether new sectoral determinations are going to be introduced. We think Section 11F needs to be expanded to make explicit that the National Minimum Wage Commission must regularly review sectoral determinations, at least every 2 years, and that it has authority to conduct investigations for such reviews and for the issue of new sectoral determinations in terms of the Act, that it's not dependent only on the Minister. Section 13, staffing of the new National Minimum Wage Commission. The National Minimum Wage Commission must be given the power to appoint its own staff and to manage them properly. It must have sufficient budget to perform all its functions effectively. The experience of the Employment Conditions Commission is that management of the Secretariat is by complaint to the Director General about its performance. The Secretariat can't actually exercise control over the staff of the Employment Conditions Commission. We think this is an unworkable arrangement and should not be allowed to continue for the National Minimum Wage Commission. The current section has the potential to significantly undermine the functioning of the National Minimum Wage Commission. Sections 15 and 16, dealing with the exemption system. The entire national minimum wage enforcement system is an application of the existing Basic Conditions of Employment Act enforcement system with some new changes, most notably the introduction of the CCMA into the enforcement system in place of the Labor Court. But when it comes to exemptions, the bill ignores the BCA exemption infrastructure and does something different, relying almost entirely on regulations which have now been published and are were open for comment until recently, which are those regulations are problematic on a number of grounds. But we can't understand why almost the entire exemption system is now being dealt with in regulations and not the architecture of the system being dealt with in the Act, in the National Minimum Wage Act, and the regulations being left to deal with the finer details of how that system works. We think it's unprecedented for regulations to take over almost this entire function of the exemption system. Schedule 1, items 2A and B. This deals with the phasing in of certain sectors to the national minimum wage. The NEDLAC agreement of February 2017 provided for a lower minimum wage for farm workers and domestic workers, subject to them being phased into the full national minimum wage over a 2-year period. However, Schedule 1 to the current bill does not prescribe a target date for when farm workers and domestic workers All workers on the EPWD and workers that have concluded learnership agreements will be phased into the full national minimum wage. That's the first problem. The second is the memorandum of objectives accompanying the national minimum wage bill states that provision for lower wages for these sectors, as provided in the schedule, are temporary exceptions to the national minimum wage for the first year. So the intention appears to be that farm workers, domestic workers, etc., will be paid the national minimum wage after 1 year, whenever the national, 1 year after the implementation date of the national minimum wage. However, Schedule 1 does not make provision for a one-year period. So there's confusion between what's in the schedule and what's in the memorandum of objectives. An alternative reading is that the National Minimum Wage Commission will recommend minimum wages for these sectors from that 1 year period after the implementation of the National Minimum Wage. But if this is the intention, the schedule should make it clear and it should not be left to the Memorandum of Objectives, which isn't part of the Act, strictly speaking. So it should be incorporated at a definite date or a definite arrangement into the National Minimum Wage Bill in Schedule 1. Notably, the Memorandum of Objectives provides no explanation of why the relevant clause in the NEDLAC agreement, in other words, a two-year phase-in, has been dropped in the bill. Schedule 1, Item 3D, discretion of the Minister as to the definition of the EPWD. This needs to be read with Section 50 of the BCA. Effectively, the definition of the EPWP in Schedule 1 gives the Minister discretion via Section 50, which allows the Minister to introduce sectoral determinations to partially exempt or to increase the range of workers that are exempted under the EPWP. We do not believe that's the intention of the National Minimum Wage Bill, to give the Minister such powers. And the result could be the fragmentation of the minimum wage bill. It should be only Parliament that makes such a decision to expand the range of exemptions under the EPWP. Okay, turning to the BCA Amendment Act, Section 1 dealing with Section 51, dealing with sectoral determinations. As I've said, the current bill has reintroduced sectoral determinations. It's transferred the process to make a sectoral determination and the functions of the ECC to the new National Minimum Wage Commission. That implies that the National Minimum Wage Commission will deal with the regular review of sectoral determinations and increase minimum wages and amend other conditions as required. However, Section 51D provides that where sectoral determination wages are higher than the national minimum wage, for the next 3 years they will automatically increase by the same proportion as the national minimum wage increases. Now, on the face of it, it's fine, but you've now got two processes to increase sectoral determination wages. One is the commission, and one is this automatic increase. We also have a concern that because there's this automatic increase, the Minister is going to be able to argue that she doesn't need to review the sectoral determinations because they're going to increase in line with the national minimum wage automatically. She won't instruct the National Minimum Wage Commission to properly review and do an amendment of the sectoral determination. We believe that's contrary to the intention of the bill. What the bill highlights is that the BCA is not sufficiently clear on the issue of regular reviews and adjustments to sectoral determinations. This, we believe, needs to be added as a specific power of the National Minimum Wage Commission, not just the issue of new sectoral determinations, but the review and update of existing sectoral determinations. Otherwise, it's dependent almost entirely on the Minister to initiate such reviews or the introductions of new sectoral determinations. Section 64DA, the exclusive jurisdiction of the CCMA to hear disputes regarding non-compliance with the national minimum wage. As I've said before, the lowest paid workers in a number of bargaining councils are going to be, their rates are going to be pushed up by the national minimum wage. So the national minimum wage is also going to be the lowest wage rate in bargaining council agreements. This creates an anomaly in that bargaining council agents or inspectors of bargaining councils are the ones that are going to be going out to firms covered by the bargaining council to do the inspections. They are the ones going to be uncovering the fact that an employer is not complying with that minimum wage, which is the wage of the bargaining council and the national minimum wage. But it's only the Department of Labor inspector that may institute proceedings against a non-compliant employer, and only the CCMA has jurisdiction to hear the dispute. So there needs to be liaison or some arrangement where the bargaining council will transfer that dispute or that non-compliance across to the Department of Labor inspector. But we also see it problematic given the amount of additional work that the CCMA is going to be given by the National Minimum Wage Bill and the changes to the enforcement system in the BCEA. We believe that the bargaining council itself should be able to enforce non-compliance where the National Minimum Wage constitutes the minimum wage of the bargaining council. Section 68.3, non-compliance with an undertaking. There are two routes that an inspector can go when he establishes non-compliance by an employer. Either he gets an undertaking from the employer or he issues a compliance order. Currently, if he gets an undertaking and the employer doesn't comply with that undertaking, that will then go to the CCMA, and the CCMA will make an arbitration award to the effect of compensation in respect of that undertaking. In other words, the underpayment that's taken place. There's no power to issue a fine. However, when there's contravention of a compliance order, you refer to, I think it's Section 76, the CCMA would be able to make the employer repay any underpayment as well as issue a fine. We don't understand why there's a distinction between non-compliance with an undertaking or in non-compliance with a compliance order. They should both be allowed to attract a fine. Okay, item 24, which deals with transitional provisions, there's a proposal to immediately on implementation, on the promulgation of the Act, disestablish the Employment Conditions Commission and introduce the National Minimum Wage Commission. We don't know how long it's going to be to actually set up a National Minimum Wage Commission. So it's short-sighted to immediately disestablish the ECC. We recommend that the ECC continue pending the establishment of the National Minimum Wage Commission so there can be a proper and seamless handover from one body to the other before the one is disestablished and the other is established, which we think can be by proclamation by the President when he promulgates the National Minimum Wage Act. Okay, finally turning to the Labor Relations Amendment Bill, I'm dealing only with a couple of sections. Those are the sections dealing with bargaining council. An extremely important amendment is made to Section 32.3 of the LRA, which deals with the extension of bargaining council agreements. It's just the change of one word, and or has been introduced instead of and between subsections B and C of that section. The implications are quite extensive. Effectively, it's the aim of this amendment is to make it easier for bargaining councils to get the agreements extended. We understand that's to protect bargaining councils, and many bargaining councils are in quite a shaky position at the moment. However, the implication is that, in fact, most bargaining councils, almost all bargaining councils, it's the employers' organizations that are relatively comfortably representative, and it's the trade unions that are struggling to maintain representativity. So in most cases, the extension of the agreement with this amendment being introduced is going to be entirely dependent on that employer's organization representativity. And weak or unorganized unions are going to be beholden to that more representative employer's organization, which is going to play out in trade-offs being demanded in the collective bargaining process. And we think this section needs to be looked at more carefully. There's also a confusing section in the Memorandum of Objectives to explain this amendment. It says, I quote, the majority of employees in the sector or to the scope of application of the agreement. In other words, the principle is now one of coverage rather than strict representativeness. First, the explanation is confusing. Second, there's no evidence in Section 32.3 or in Section 49, which one needs to read in at the same time as Section 32, of this distinction being mentioned in the Memorandum of Objects. Effectively, Section 32.3 B and C is the same as in the bill is the same as the current wording in the LRA. So there seems to have been thinking behind this amendment, which hasn't been translated into the wording of the Act. We think that needs to be looked at again. Lastly, just Section 32.3b and Section 49.4a, which is about determining representativity of parties. These two sections refer to each other for authority. We believe that's problematic. The one should provide clear authority. The sections are going to be challenged. They are critical sections that employers' organizations against the bargaining council system have challenged in the past. Any loophole that they see with regard to this is going to be challenged now. So those sections need to be clarified and made watertight. Finally, Section 49.4a, again dealing with determining representativity. It's anomalous that Section A refers only to employers' organizations and not to trade unions. There should be an equivalent clause for trade unions to determine representativity. There's also a mix-up with the, it should actually be C rather than, should be 32.3C rather than 32.3B. But that's not the main problem. It doesn't refer to trade unions. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Dr. Godfrey from Labour Enterprise Policy Research Group for your presentation. At this stage, I'll allow members to ask questions. You note their questions and then you respond later. Honourable Magwebu, let me welcome organizations that have just joined us. You're welcome. Honorable Makwebu, Honorable Zwane, yeah, so far, and Honorable Mapue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Dr. Shane Godfrey, for your input. We appreciate it. Two things, Chairperson, really. I want to confirm from the doctor if my understanding is correct, that in principle we are not opposed to the minimum wage bill, right? Then here is then the second issue, Chair. If, in fact, your presentation in the main raises a lot of legal technicalities, it is characterized by legal technicalities. You raise issues of broader definitions that should be considered, inconsistencies between one section of the Act with another section in the same Act or and in another section of the Act as you have raised them. Also, you're raising issues that one section is repugnant to another section of the same Act or repugnant to the section of another Act that you have articulated. You also raise issues of jurisdictions of the CCMA vis-a-vis bargaining councils. You also raise issues of undertakings and compliance and issues of same sections that may, some sections that may be confusing. So in my view, Chairperson, through you, this matter indeed, his presentation 99% is characterized by legal technicalities, and therefore we would need those that are adequately legally trained, namely our legal services in Parliament, to assist us, you know, given the presentation of Dr. Shane Godfrey. And therefore, all we could say, Chairperson, is just my comment, is that we heard you. We would not be able to have time and
to really to deal with those legal technicalities. It's just my view, Chair. Then before this process is finalized, I'm sure through you, Chair, your guidance, legal services will sit and analyze your submission and give us a legal opinion, you know, see if once we take the process forward to finality. That's just the comment, Chair. Nothing further. And then we can move to the next presentation.
I'm not sharing their heads that was considered Honorable Zwane.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I actually was going to agree with Honorable Mokubi, but I'm not going to agree with him anymore because he's shutting me out. I don't know why. Nonetheless, on a serious note, what he's saying is quite correct. This is quite technical, and it would really meet the eye of legal expertise because there are areas where you talk of the powers of the minister vis-a-vis the powers of some of the bodies that are going to be constituted. When I read as a layman, it appears as though there are sections where you intend that the bill erodes the powers of the minister and apportions those powers to some of the bodies and even to parliament. So these are the issues where I say I tend to agree with Honorable Makwebe to say we need the assistance of the legal team to actually clarify some of the issues that are contained herein. It shows, though, that it's quite academic. We appreciate your input, but we need assistance to get further clarity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I find the presentation to be very helpful because of its objectivity. We have very many other presentations that come from a group that has a direct interest in the matter, and academia has an important role to play with regard to the nurturing of our democracy. And we thank you for that, Doctor. My first question would be that I see your presentation is dated the 8th of June. Now, last week we had the trade unions participating in NEDLAC doing a presentation to us. And they emphasized why they choose the CCMA rather than bargaining councils. Have you listened to their presentation, and what would be your take on them coming to us making a strong presentation on that? Let me link that with my second question. The difficulty that we have as legislatures is that we have to subject ourselves to democratic practices. What would you say if we have a minority opinion being expressed to us? Do we need to incorporate that, or do we rather need to conform to the majority? My third point, Chairperson, is your reference to the Memorandum of Objectives and the regulations. We find very often that there is a lot of detail that we are cautious to write into the Act itself, because then, as my mentor has trained me, what happens is that we paint ourselves in a corner, and it's more difficult to change an Act than what it is to adapt the regulations. Would you have a problem then if that explanation is given, that the detail has been excluded from a memorandum because we are looking in the Act itself, because we're looking at including that in the as an appendix? My final point would just be, Chairperson, I notice that you have in your presentation a section that deals with the NEDLAC, but you have just skipped that completely. Because my next question is related to, and your pages are not numbered, which makes it difficult, but you have Schedule 1, Item 2A and B, the phasing in of certain sectors international minimum wage. I hope you are with me on that. And there you mentioned the NEDLAG agreement. Now, I want to know whether you have any difficulties with the NEDLAG agreement, but have a big part to that question. As academia, have you made an effort to engage with the role players in NEDLAG? It can be either yes or no. You could give a motivation why you have not done that. Then my final point is, Chair, on the heading where we have the BCEA Amendment Act. There you have a sentence that starts with, however, Section 51(3). And then you mention that it also suggests that the Minister of Labour will argue that she does not need to initiate reviews of the STs. I find it very strange that you can read the minister's mind. Can you help us understand what exactly do you mean there? Because it's also, for me, casting an aspersion on what the minister will do. Because we have oversight over the work of the minister and think that it indirectly also impacts on what we will do. Thank you very much, Chair.
The other hands? Okay. Perhaps let me explain the process that we'll be embarking upon. After all the oral submissions, members, the Department of Labor is going to respond to all the submissions, the oral submission as well as the written submissions. And then we'll find time to deliberate on all the submissions and the responses of the Department of Labor. But what I would advise, especially to members of the committee, I know we have alternates that have not been familiar with the bills, is that what you should have in front of you are the original bills. You must also have the acts, all the acts, the Labor Relations Act, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. So you must have those. So that, especially during the constituency period, so that when you look at the bills, the original bills from the Department of Labor on national minimum wage, on Basic Conditions of Employment Act, and Labor Relations Act, the amendment bills. But also you must have acts, the current act, for instance, Labor Relations of 1995. And also you must have the Basic Condition of Employment Act. Right. Because when you interact with the submissions and the bills, you must also refer to the current act, because there have not yet been amendment until with or without amendments. But if with amendment, then it will have to go back to the National Assembly. So this is a advice that I want to make, that because if you look at just the submissions without having all the documents in front of you, so what I suggest during constituency period, what is going to happen? We're going to, after the oral submissions, the response by the Department of Labor, then we're going to have a report that contains all the submissions and the responses of the Department of Labor. And then when we meet in the third term in August, we will deliberate based on the report, on the submissions, the responses, but as I was indicating, that in front of you must have all the bills, including the portfolio committee amendments. Remember, we've got the original bills from the Department of Labor, and also we have the amendments from the portfolio committee. So those must be also in front of you. And then the acts, you must have, for example, this is the 1995 Labor Relations Act number
66 of 1995. This one also has regulations, so you must have this in front of you, so that when it refers to Section 64, you must go to Section 64 and see what is the current labor relation says on Section 64. What is it that now in the national minimum wage is being proposed with regard to Section 64 or any of its subsections? So otherwise, if you don't have this, you won't be able to know what is being proposed. So that's what I wanted to suggest before I allow Dr. Godfrey to respond. So that then will assist us when we deliberate. I'll give you just now, I've noted you, Honourable Faber. I just wanted to clarify that, because not only with this presentation, but also with previous presentations, where there were proposals with regard to changes of the clauses. You have the submission by an organization, and then you refer to the original bill, you refer to the act, that then will assist you. Honourable Faber.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson, just Dr. Godfrey was giving us this presentation, and I think I want to actually agree upon what you're saying, because, I mean, we don't know what interaction was between the Department of Labour and the different groups at this stage, and the legal aspects, if it was ironed out perhaps on certain things that the department might have a different view on after deliberations. So for myself, asking maybe one or two questions now will be preempting maybe what the Department of Labor might suggest later on. So it makes it difficult for asking questions where the department might have already reconsidered one or two other aspects. So I would actually suggest, I don't want to change this whole day around, but perhaps also let the deliberations go on, let the Department of Labor then speak to us on it, and let we then ask the questions, because there might be, I don't want to be out of order, Chairperson, but I just believe that there might be things that might have been picked up by the department that we might ask now, and the department will in any case answer us on. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. No, I was just advising particularly that will be on constituency period, what will be assisting us when we come back to deliver it. That the documents that must be in front of you are the bills from the Department of Labor, one. Two, the amendment bills from Portfolio Committee. Three, the current laws. On Labor Relations Act, the Basic Condition of Employment Act, as well as, because there's no National Act currently. But also you can have the Employment Equity, because Dr. Godfrey refer also to Employment Equity, if you could have those. And then you must then have all the submissions, so that as you, on your own, trying to interact with the documents, you refer to all these documents. And then also the last one, we have circulated the NEDLAC agreement. You have those in your emails. You must also refer to that. If, for example, Dr. Davis or IEJ, you remember last week IEJ was also talking about the NEDLAC agreement. You must refer to that. What did it say on a particular proposal that an organization is making, for that? And then when we come back in August, at least you have the background of what was taking place. Welcome, Honorable Samka. Can you then, Doc, respond to the questions?
Thank you, and thank you for those comments and questions. I agree entirely. It's a very technical submission, and as I said, it's based on a research project which looked at precisely these issues where there might be friction, inconsistencies, etc., to try and lessen that so that the national minimum wage would be introduced in its most effective form. I'm happy to communicate or meet with the legal services or the parliamentary legal advisor if he or she wants to discuss the submission further as your deliberations continue to explain any of the points. So we'd make ourselves available for that. I don't, just on the five questions that were asked, I haven't seen the trade union presentation where they made an argument for the CCMA rather than the bargaining councils to deal with disputes about the national minimum wage. I think I understand why they've gone with the CCMA, because of greater consistency possibly in how they deal with those disputes. My concern is about the workload of the CCMA. And the LRA allowed for bargaining councils to be accredited precisely so that some of that workload could shift to bargaining councils to deal with disputes in their sectors. And that's not the case with dealing with the national minimum wage. So, no, we don't know at this point which would be the optimal option to go, but I'm raising this because of a concern with how much workload is being added to the CCMA. Minority position versus the majority position, I mean, that's an interesting one. I don't think one can have a hard and fast rule about that. I mean, obviously, if Kasatu makes an argument, it carries a certain weight, particularly in political terms, but I don't think that should exclude a minority position being looked at carefully within the structures of the legislation and so on, and possibly making more sense than a majority position. I think one shouldn't be bound simply by the majority position. The memorandum of objectives, you're talking about the details and the regulations, I was a little bit confused about. I think there needs to be a balance between what's in the Act and what's in regulations. And I think the current exemption system as proposed in the bill is way overbalanced in favor of the regulations. There's too much in the regulations, not enough in the Act. And I think that the basic architecture of the system should be in the Act. The nitty-gritty and the workings of the system should be in the regulations, and that balance isn't right. The NEDLAC agreement, I've referred to that. I've had extensive engagement with the Labour constituency in NEDLAC, not with the other parties, though, but I've been in regular contact with them. I agree, it's perhaps presumptuous me reading into what the Minister of Labour is going to do in the submission. We are concerned about never having been given adequate reasons by the Department of Labour in prior, and this goes back to the Memorandum of Objectives, that doesn't explain why two chapters of the BCA was proposed to be repealed. And I can understand the ECC chapter, but the sectoral determination chapter wasn't explained why that's going to be the case in the Memorandum of Objectives. And there was no subsequent explanation of why sectoral determinations should be excluded. It made no sense to us why sectoral determinations were excluded, but it seemed to us the Department of Labor was extremely reluctant to change their minds and bring sectoral determinations back. When they did bring it back, it struck us that it still depends very largely on the Minister of Labor. And drawing an inference from that reluctance of the department to still accommodate sectoral determinations in the Act, we believe that there's going to be, we think one can make a reasonable assumption that there's going to be a reluctance to continue sectoral determinations as regularly and as effectively as they have been done in the past. That's what I was reading. Thank you. I hope I've answered those adequately.
Thank you very much, Doc. As I keep on saying, is that we'll consider all the submissions that have been presented to us. But also going back to members, is that, you know, as I was indicating the document that you must refer to, you'll find at the end of the day that without undermining the views that are expressed by members, you find that there's nothing technical about it. It's either you agree with the proposal or you don't agree. Once you refer to all the documents, study them,
because all that the organization is doing is to make proposals. All that we'll then have to deliberate is whether we agree or we do not agree with the proposals. That's why I'm saying that once you refer to all the documents I was referring you to, with due respect, you'll find that there's nothing technical. It's either you accept the proposal or you don't accept the proposal. But that will be influenced by when you have studied the bills from the original bills from the department, the bills from the portfolio committee, and the current acts, as well then the submissions. When there's a submission, you refer to the original bill, you refer to the bill from the portfolio committee, you refer to the current act. That makes it easier. And then you then decide whether you agree then with the proposal itself, because you have understood what the bills are saying and also what the current act is saying. So thank you very much, Doc, for your presentation. Again, when we deliberate, we'll consider the views that you have expressed. Thank you very much. The next presentation, honorable members, according to the program, I must indicate that we're running behind the schedule, is the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Mr. Jeff Jacobs. Are you having PowerPoint presentation? I don't know why this time around parties are reluctant to make PowerPoint presentation. It makes it quicker and assists us. I hope NUMSA, I see they've got two laptops there. I'm sure they also have a PowerPoint presentation. Pardon me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and members of the Select Committee, and all other guests that are present. I think you're going to find that the presentation we'll do will be not as technical as the previous one and will certainly be a lot shorter than the first presentation that was done. So the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry was founded in 1804, incorporated by an Act of Parliament in 1891, so you can see it's an organization that's been going for a very long time. In fact, I think it's the oldest member-based chamber in the continent of Africa. We represent more than 2,000 businesses in the Western Cape, and we provide a wide range of services assisting these businesses and offering them the opportunity to excel. So as a non-partisan organization, our submissions, we believe, are the crucial voice of business in the region. So I want to start with two general comments and then get into two or three more specific comments. Firstly, the general comments. The Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry has already commented on the principles and implications of these amended pieces of legislation before us. And our primary concern, espoused previously and which we now affirm, is the administrative burden these amended pieces of legislation will place on business, especially small businesses with limited resources. Of the more than 2,000 businesses that we represent, probably about 60% of them can be defined as small businesses, in other words, 1 to 10 employees in those businesses. So administrative burden is a big concern for us. So that's our first general comment that we'd like to make. The second comment we'd like to make is about the Department of Labor's ability to cope with the increased workload these amendments will introduce. We've got quite a big contingent from the Department of Labor, so I must choose my words carefully. But it's our view that enforcement and compliance have been a challenge for the Department of Labor. And our position is that we need to remove rather than add, and we need to simplify rather than complicate the legislative framework as a positive step moving forward. So those are the two general comments we'd like to make. So now we move to the specific inputs. Firstly, around affordability. We're concerned about the affordability of increasing unemployment insurance fund benefits from 238 to 365 days. And we envisage that the likelihood of monthly UIF contributions by both employers and employees will have to be increased in order to afford that change in the legislation. Secondly, we welcome enlightened policies and provisions on maternity and paternity leave, but they too come at a cost. Many companies make significant contributions to staff on maternity leave, and any small businesses having to pay benefits to two or three staff at the same time, as well as their temporary replacements, could find itself in financial difficulty. Still under the heading of affordability with regard to the national minimum wage, we acknowledge that the legislation provides for exemptions, but it is our view that the procedure to obtain exemptions will be lengthy and therefore costly. In particular, the requirements for supporting documentation are onerous, especially audited documents on affordability, liquidity, and profitability of the business. In the case of new small businesses with short track records, this can be an impossible demand to meet. New small businesses, particularly in townships and rural areas, need to be encouraged and not handicapped with excessive red tape burdens. So our previous point has relevance. Given the Department of Labor's challenge on enforcement, a likely scenario is that struggling small business owners and entrepreneurs will simply ignore the legislation and employ people at wages they can afford, thus undermining complex but well-meaning legislation. Second area we want to talk about specifically is the Labor Relations Amendment Bill and dealing with strikes. Strikes are a very serious problem in South Africa as they're usually accompanied by intimidation, violence and the destruction of property, something this country cannot afford as it adds to the costs while discouraging both local and overseas investment. We recognize therefore that the legislation attempts to deal with this problem by creating an advisory arbitration panel that will, on an expedited basis, investigate the cause and circumstances of a strike or lockout. The intention is admirable, but we have great doubts about its prospects of success and the ability to make advisory awards in a short time. Our issue is around the speed with which these things can be resolved. There's a real risk of unions or employers abusing the process, thus causing delays and postponements while the pressure continues to build around the workplace. The risk is that the new process could extend rather than curtail strikes. And we must also take into account that the new process will only come into effect after a strike has been running for some time and therefore after attitudes may have hardened. The final comment we want to make is in relation to unemployment, a point that was made by the first delegation. The most pressing crisis facing our country, namely the growing number of people, especially young people, in the ranks of the unemployed. In our previous submission, we pointed out that the new minimum wage was likely to lead to job losses as firms reassessed their staff requirements and resorted to more automation to improve productivity. As the Chamber, we are still of this view. The Chamber believes that the litmus test for any legislation that could impact unemployment is a simple question. Will this legislation encourage businesses to employ more people? If the answer is yes, then the legislation is good and we should probably support it. If the answer is no, then it should be rejected. Our view is that we cannot afford to go backwards in our attempt to create more jobs and reduce unemployment. And we request the committee to consider our submission in a positive light, thereby ensuring the growth of our local and national economy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tseko. Members, any questions to the input? Honorable Makwebu, Honorable Dlamini. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
And thank you, sir, for your presentation. Appreciate it. I just want to find out a few things, really. The issues that you have raised seem to suggest that if they can be addressed, then the minimum wage is not the issue. You are agreeable that time has arrived in this country that there should be a minimum wage. However, you are raising certain issues that you think are not adequately addressed, and if they could be adequately addressed, then you wouldn't have qualms or issues with the national minimum wage. For instance, you're talking about issues that must be addressed, where you state that the Department of Labor already has demonstrated that they don't have capacity to enforce non-compliance. If that issue can be addressed, then no problems, right? Issue of Department of CCMA may not have capacity to enforce or to, you know, to dispense redress when necessary. That could lead to lengthy drawn-out processes. And if CCMA beefs up capacity, then no problems. Minimum wage must come. Am I right, sir, in my understanding? Then finally, I'm happy to realize that you are happy with other legislations, as expressed in your presentations, that is recognizing men, their role in paternity leave. You welcome that, and that's good. And I'm sure every reasonable South African welcomes that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Let me welcome the presentation. And in terms of the comments, I want to start with the paternity leave. That is a challenge, according to them. Just to remind the presenter that the work force or the labor force is within the childbearing age. And I'm sure you will agree with me that children don't belong to one parent, they belong to both. It was even more difficult to introduce the maternity leave, if you remember by then. But now we are saying both parents must take responsibility. What is your suggestion? If you think this is a challenge, who should stay at home and look after a child? The maternity leave is there already. Should we scrap it and put a paternity leave? The father stays at home, because the mother anyway will be carrying a baby for 9 months. Maybe the time for the father to take these 3 months and bring up a child. What is your suggestion there? Then the second one is on the minimum wage versus automation. I don't see a relationship there. How do you relate the two? Because whether we introduce the minimum wage or not, the fourth industrial revolution is here, which is the biggest threat in terms of job losses. Whether minimum wage or not is there, is here. How do you relate these two? Because if your reason is to improve productivity, meaning that the minimum wage has got nothing to do with your reasoning behind, how do you relate the two? Thank you, Chair.
Mazwan.
Thank you, Chairperson. We welcome the presentation. I want to believe, Chairperson, that we should appreciate the fact that the legislation does give a scope for small business, for instance, to apply for exemptions. But your qualms about that is that it's going to be onerous and it requires a lot of time. But I think we should appreciate the fact that there is a way a small business is going to be protected even though the minimum wage act is passed. At the end of your presentation, I don't get clarity in terms of what is it that you are saying. Are you saying that you are against the introduction of this minimum wage bill or act? Because you say the litmus test is whether we are going to increase employment by the introduction of the bill or decrease employment. We have not tested the waters. So I'm not sure you are on the fence there. You are neither supporting nor negating. I just see clarity in that regard.
Any more questions? Not. Mr. Jacobs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the members of the committee for the questions. So let me start with the last question first, and the suggestion that we're sitting on the fence in relation to this. I think it's quite clear that the issues we raise around the amended legislation are not in relation to the technicalities of the legislation, but the intent behind the legislation. And so in summary, I think the point that we're making could be summarized under the three C's: the costs, the compliance, and the complexity issues. We're in support of the amendments if the costs can be addressed, the cost issues, the affordability issues can be addressed. If compliance, not necessarily beefed up, because our position as a chamber is that lighter government is more advantageous for small business than heavier government. So we don't necessarily support stricter compliance. We want simple legislation, and that's the issue of complexity. So reduce complexity, go for simpler legislation, reduce compliance by having a lighter touch from government, and reduce the cost. That's our overall position as the Chamber of Commerce and Industry. So we're not sitting on the fence. We're saying let's address the issues that are coming out in these proposed amendments to the legislation. So I think I've addressed the first question. Is it Honorable Huero, is it, that asked the question? Magwebu. Honorable Magwebu. My apologies. Compliance of the DOL and CCMA beefing up compliance, I think I've answered the question that we do need to find a way to enforce what already exists, but we also don't want a heavy-handed approach to how we implement these things. The question around paternity leave, who should take responsibility? I don't know if that's a judgment call you're asking the chamber to make. Obviously, we believe that both parents should be taking responsibility for the rearing of the kids, and so we welcome the notion of paternity leave, but again, the issue of affordability or the issue of costs comes into play. And then the point really around automation, around the minimum wage, is the point around the costs of doing business. For small businesses, affordability is the key. And so when you increase the cost of doing business, you're going to force small businesses to go the route of looking at more efficient ways of doing things, automation. I'm glad you mentioned the fourth industrial revolution, but that speaks about skills and the importance of skills, and so we can't address these issues without taking into account the need to upskill our population. So we're not opposed to the national minimum wage. We're just concerned about the possible implications around costs and affordability. I don't know if... Okay, the small business, yeah, there's scope for small businesses to apply for exemptions, but again, the issue that we've raised is around the complexity of that process. Can that process be simplified? So our message, I think, to the Select Committee is let's see if we can simplify things, let's see if we can reduce the costs of doing business, and let's see if we can improve compliance through a lighter touch from government. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if that answers the questions.
Thank you very much for your presentations, and also thank you very much for responding to the questions, and also thank you for coming. We will deliberate on your presentation when we have a meeting of the committee to consider the submissions that have been made and also the responses from the department. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity.
Honourable members, that brings us to the next presentation by Mr. Chris Lobsha and Christian Olufsen, of the Moody and Robertson Attorney. 30 minutes. You have a PowerPoint presentation. Very good. Okay.
Ready. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Lobsha. I represent the South African Security Association. My colleague, Mr. Ulofse, from the organization called SANSEA. Both of us are important organizations in the private security sector. And I want to thank honorable members and chairman and representatives from the Department of Labor for the opportunity given to us today. Just some background on to our credentials. We represent our members here today who employ in excess of 176,000 employees in the private security sector. We are the two parties that represent the industry at the National Bargaining Forum negotiate terms and conditions of employment in the sector. There's some 20 trade unions that sit at the National Bargaining Forum. We sit normally every 3 years, and the past history is that we've been settling on 3-year wage agreements because of the size of the industry and the impact thereof. Our members are required to sign a voluntary code that they will uphold the ethics and the values of the professionalization of the industry, which requires significant compliance. In our industry, those of you that may not know, we have a regulatory authority in the industry called CIRA, the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority, that regulate our industry in terms of compliance. And there's numerous compliance issues in our industry because of the character and the impact that the industry may have out there in terms of crime. There's some 7,000 security companies registered. The latest CIRA numbers closer to 8,000 or just in excess of 8,000. The industry in totality employs around about 500,000 people. That's not just guards, but all the rest of the positions in the industry. You've got people in alarms and technology and the rest. Some 150,000 new jobs, mostly for youth, was created in our industry in the last 5 years. And with that comes significant investment in skills and the development of people, be that at an entry level. We have a very long history in collective bargaining. We have been self-determining our remuneration for the last 10 years. The compliance sector of the industry, and when I say the compliance sector, we categorize or we look at this industry in terms of two parts. You've got employers that are following the rules and complying with the laws, and then you've got a very, very big non-compliant part of our industry that do not follow the rules and do not comply with the laws of the country. And that's a scary thought if you think of the industry that we're in. We applied for a bargaining council application made last year, February, and there's a gentleman here, Mr. Nkalipi, that's very well versed with our application, and we popped some champagne and drank some whiskey last week on Friday when we received the good news that we've been granted our bargaining council for the industry last Friday. So we are very new to this process of bargaining council, so we've got some work in front of us, but we are willing and able to go into that process. I just want to give you a very quick background. I'm also going to be very quick. It's not a technical one. So just before I go into the timeline, I know, just let me preempt two questions that I know is coming. We are not opposed to the national minimum wage and the implementation thereof, so I just wanted to get that out of the way so we can relax and move on. And then the second part is that we are there to professionalize the industry and to ensure compliance, especially taking into consideration the industry that we're in. So I just wanted to get that out of the way quickly. The industry started off very unorganized, and a lot of exploitative practices took place in this industry when it started. It was a new industry, and a lot of unethical employers started to operate in this industry. In 1993, centralized bargaining commenced in this industry, and that started to lead to wage determinations and later on sectoral determinations, as it was later called. In 2006 was a very important year for our industry. Those of you who may have longer memories, we had a very long 3-month unprotected strike with around about 100 or so deaths that we know of that took place. Very violent things that took place, people thrown off trains and it changed the industry from there on. In 2008, we settled to put in place a national bargaining forum agreement with, as I said previously, some 20 trade unions that participate in the two employers' organizations. I just mentioned in 2017 we applied for bargaining council, and on the 22nd of June last week we were told that we were provided with our bargaining council registration. Noteworthy, since 2006 and that terrible strike we had, there's been no strike emanating from negotiations at a central level. So we cleared our minds. I think both the trade unions and the employers realized the massive impact of our centralized negotiations and what it does on this industry and the potential for violence that we have because of the kind of industry that we're in. You must remember that we operate in every sector. We've got security officers posted everywhere in the country at any market or any kind of business that you can think of. So we are everywhere. And the potential for that in terms of people mostly self-posting themselves, the violence that can take place and the impact of a strike in our industry is actually very, very heavy because people are then attacked at trains or in taxis or the potential is quite high. And the impact on crime in our country is enormous. So since then, as I said, no strikes have taken place and from humble beginnings, we have tripled the minimum wage for a security officer, and we've had very complicated agreements that's taken place between the two parties. When I say there's been no strikes that took place since 2001, does not mean that our negotiations were not excessively robust. When we meet with our trade unions and in that room with 20 trade unions and two employees' organizations, it is a rough process. You're sitting with some very interesting trade unions that are not scared to put forward their position. These unions include SATAWU, AMCU, recently the National Union of Mine Workers, NUMSA, KAWU, and a few others of significant importance. So the settlements that we reached, unfortunately, you can't see so nicely on the screen. But since 2006, our increases have been significantly more than CPI, and our minimum wage went from 1,155 in 2006 to triple that to 3,400 and something in the last round of negotiations. If I look at just in terms of how we pay a security officer, we pay currently a basic monthly salary, and then you've got a whole range of payments that take place. So the payment that a security officer gets is more in the region of, if you're a grade A security officer, 12,000 rand a month. It's not just a minimum wage. We've got private security provident fund, 7.5% contributed by the employers, 7.5% contributed by the employees. We've got numerous allowances, night shift allowances, mobile security officer, firearm allowances. So the payment is significant more than what you would just look at just that basic minimum wage. So the trade-offs took place, and when you do this collective bargaining, what happens is that you will have a lot of issues that conflict with each other, and it's a fine, fine balancing act to decide where you're going to go and what you're going to give. We were unaware of a national minimum wage coming into play when we had our last negotiations, and trade-offs were made in terms of a number of issues. So what then happened is that then comes this external factor, and we had, for example, five grades. You had grade A to E over time. That was reduced to basically three. The others still exist, but the grade C gets the same minimum wage. A grade E gets the same minimum wage as a grade C. We also reduced the number of areas that we had. We had rural areas, urban, but we had three areas, and we've over time reduced that to two. So what we were left in terms of the equivalent hourly wage is two significant problems, and that would be
Area 3, which is your more, let me call it the deep rural areas, a number of honourable members here represent those constituencies, where you have Area 3 Grade C will be paid 16.41 rand hourly wage, but over and above that they get all the other allowances and the rest, and Grade B is 18.91 rand. So that is the situation. We're in two specific problems. There's also a small matter of a grade C in Area 1, but that should be sorted out very quickly. So the reason for our submission is a very simple one. We've got four issues that we believe drive this. The first one is the affordability, and it's not our affordability. It's the affordability of the client to pay for the security officer. And significantly, we will be talking about people, clients in rural areas. The second one is job losses. It's linked to affordability, but that we believe is specifically in these rural areas are going to have a massive impact. The third one is linked to the job losses would be non-compliance. If you look at the rural areas non-compliance, our estimate is it's in the region of 80%. Where I'm sure you will drive around and you will see that a security officer in a rural community will not have a provident fund. They will not be paid overtime. Their hours of remuneration, they'll be working 360 hours a month. The exploitation is massive as we stand. And we believe this will just drive that non-compliance even more if the national minimum wage is just implemented like that. And then the impact on crime, where clients will be forced to utilize unprofessional companies. They will drive these exploitative practices, and that will open the door for increased crime and unprofessional provision of security services. So if I just quickly go into the affordability. As I said, we previously spoke about the clients. Clients in rural, and when I talk clients, I'm talking about the a business, for example, small businesses, the mining industry. Both Mr. Ulofsson and ourselves, myself, work for companies that do work from the mining sector. Just at this moment in time, by letting some of these clients know that the national minimum wage is coming, we have already been flooded with requests to reduce the numbers of security officers accordingly. It's a very simple thing. They'll say, keep your price the same, but reduce the number of security officers. So that means that your provision will be far less in terms of employees that will work there, and your ability to provide a professional services drops, and that will have an impact that we believe a significant impact in crime, especially if you're looking at the mining industry where copper theft and the rest is taking place. So we believe that that will have a huge impact. Our collective agreement that we've had in the past, as we've spoken earlier, has already addressed the issues of that's the same intention as the national minimum wage. We have been looking at uplifting that bottom end quite significantly, and we've been working on that. That's why we've been reducing grades, and we have been reducing the areas. If we had known 3 years ago that the national minimum wage would have come in, it may have been that we would not have introduced as many allowances, or the increases in allowances may have reduced. Even our intention was to reduce the impact of that differential in the rural areas. We put in place an allowance in grade 3, or area 3, for those specific workers, and they are obtaining a 90 rand a month allowance in area 3 to compensate for the differentiation. So we were working on these issues long before the national minimum wage came into play. And I spoke earlier about the trade-offs that we make during negotiations, so that would have been an issue that we would have dealt with. And then I need not say any more. I think the economists can help us here. Witson University of Cape Town can tell us the situation of companies or businesses in rural communities. I think they are taking some serious strain. Job losses we spoke about, I don't want to go into that any further. The non-compliance issues, there's a number of ways that companies out there, unscrupulous, unethical providers utilize to avoid compliance. There's some, as I said, 8,000 security companies. We've got an industry provident fund that every security company needs to register to and contribute to the employees. Of the 8,000 companies, there's around about 80 of them that are fully compliant with the provident fund. The rest of them do not either bother to even contribute, or secondly, they would take money from security officers, put it in their own back pockets, don't pay it across, or pay sporadically, and the theft and misuse of security officers in terms of the provident fund is enormous. So that's a massive issue for us. In terms of the SD6, its complexity makes it, the sectoral determination, its complexity makes it, the ability to not comply with it very easy, because the Department of Labor is not focused necessarily on those specific items, and it's very difficult to come and police whether somebody is playing a night shift allowance. It's easier to police other issues, but it's because of the complex nature, it allows for that non-compliance to take place. A lot of companies don't register with the Private Security Regulatory Authority and just employ any person off the street without the necessary qualifications, and they stand guard, and we all know the impact of that. Then, also in terms of the negative impact on crime, we believe that if your non-compliance goes up, your unprofessional security companies increase, their ability to provide proper security services are not at the level that it should be, and that opens up increasing crime, especially in these rural communities. And then just in closing, basically what we are asking is that we agree to go and comply with the national minimum wage. We agree with the intentions thereof. We have got no issue with it. What we are requesting is a provision or an allowance for a 3-year period that we can minimize this impact of the national minimum wage, so that in 3 years' time, the impact on the clients in the rural areas are, let's call it, smoothed, so that we can actually do this with the impact of that being less. And that will also allow us, in terms of our wage negotiations, to focus these trade-offs so that we can focus more on the minimum wage rather than increasing all the other benefits that we have been doing in the recent past. So in summary, that's our situation, and we thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir, for your input. I'll ask the members if having any questions. Honorable Faba, Honorable Magwebu, Honorable Makuwe, Honorable Lamini, in that order. Welcome, Honorable Dr. Matime.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, yes. We are obviously concerned about job losses in any sector, not just in the security sector. And this is why we, if you could recall in last week, we also said that in certain sectors we must maybe look at sectorial wages in certain sectors as a minimum wage. But then again, as I am full aware of, that certain security companies, the owners do have certain higher profit margins. Now, as soon as a security company's profit margin is higher, it gets down to it that they will say to these people, but we can only give you X amount of security guards for this amount. And they will let one or two security guards go so that they can keep their profit margins. So this is a worry to me, because it's also, again, in the catch-22 situation where you're saying that security guards must get X amount, which is true. But I can assure you that some of the security companies, and I've actually got a property on an estate where we changed security companies, where the one was excessively higher than the others, and he said that he had to actually let two of his security guards go because he cannot afford, according to the grading, these security guards, and he gave us a nice layout on all his expenses. But it is quite funny that another company from Johannesburg came in, gave us security guards, same grading, everything, and they could do that. So I still think and believe that the profit margins of these companies do play a certain role in it. I don't want to say to private companies what their percentage of profits should be. I don't think we can regulate that. That is their own business. But I do think that is maybe one of the criteria that can cause problems.
Just to clarify, we have not agreed on the issue of a sectoral minimum, which we don't have a position as a select committee as yet. We are hearing the views of the stakeholders. We're still going to deliberate on these issues. So I just wanted to correct you on that one. Honorable Makwebu.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, Mr. Lobsa, for your presentation. Quickly, I would want to invite your comment, and then I'll ask a few questions, but this is just inviting your comment on this one. Is my understanding correct, or what would be your comment if I argue with you and say, you know, these allowances that you are giving to your employees, that is the security guards, and inherent in that profession, and therefore it cannot be seen as going an extra mile or loving them and being nice to them. It's just inherent that they need fire allowances, they need night shift allowances. It's because of it's inherent in their profession, the work they do. Just like anyone would have traveling allowance if he has to do the job, otherwise how would you travel? So you're not doing anyone a favor. What would be your comment to that? Then here is the question. You're saying to us you don't have a problem with minimum wage, and brilliant. But however, your significant problem, you are worried about your, for lack of a better word, your rural constituency or your rural security folks who are there. Currently, you're paying them 1641, 1891, and therefore that constituency will struggle to meet the minimum wage. I'm sure you are aware that given those struggles, they'll have to apply for exemptions. Then what is the problem with that? Because the exemption, in my view, is a simple process. You put up your financial statements, you become transparent, you say, look, I can't afford this, and this is my turnover I make, it's tough in this corner, and then sure, labor will be reasonable. What's your problem with that? Would you want more simplified? Like, what will others argue that maybe the exemption is a problem for you in one way or the other? What's your response to that? And finally, you know, you talk about 3 years to prepare for yourselves. I'm not sure what you mean by that. What is this preparation, because you have to work on what you have. 3 years down the line, the economy may shrink further. But you work with what you have, so you will still have to come forward and say, 3 years down the line, things have become tougher, and then you apply for exemption. Labor would have to be reasonable and consider that exemption. So we cannot be sitting here and thinking that 3 years would be a better place for South Africans. We don't know the future. We can only work on what we have and stay positive. So all I'm asking you is, why would you think 3 years would be better? Why can't you just move now? Because you have a recourse in the event of a lack of affordability. I'm talking genuine cases. Like Honorable Fabes argued, there are cases that are not genuine. People want to keep the profit margins, then they'll just have to retrench and send people away. Those are what I call, with due respect, unscrupulous people. They are not patriotic South Africans. I don't want to argue, as some people argue, that they're just a capitalist of the worst kind. What's your response to that?
Honourable Makwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question would be that I noticed that you've made a presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Labour on the 14th of March, and that's contained here. My question then would be, is there anything new in your presentation today that you did not present to the Portfolio Committee on Labour? My second question is precluded by a comment. I find it very disturbing that you're using the lowest paid workers, farm workers and domestic workers, as a rationale for your difficulty with the minimum wage. Security officers are at much greater risk than farm workers and domestic workers. And I think as attorneys, one would expect you to actually appreciate that and look at the risk. And then finally, to just say, Chairperson, that if the presentation, and say that there are certain things that you need to deal with organized labor. And I see in one of your documents, the longer version, you are saying what are the demands of organized labor. We are not, as this committee, going to engage with that. We leave it for you to resolve those matters at that level. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Zami.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation. I'm not sure how to engage with this presentation, Chair, because you have organized labor, the unions, who represent directly the security. You have business who are contributing. Earlier we had a Cape Chamber, which is representing business. You are the middleman. I'm not sure whether I'm using the right term. As you present, you are talking about your clients who are saying, no, don't touch money that you are getting, but just reduce the number of people. That results into job loss. What we are missing here is your management cost. How much money do you put as a middleman? That is one question. I'm not saying tell me now, but I'm just asking myself, because it's not straight from your client straight to the security. In between there is you. You take something there. We don't know how much is that something. And how much does it contribute to the job loss? If those people were directly appointed, I'm just thinking something that is not here, or directly appointed by your clients, will they be job losses? I'm saying that because I look at the difference of 3.5 and the 3.14. The difference is 87 rand. You may find that you are taking more than that for management costs, which I don't blame you, because you have to pay to manage the security activities as a company. So what I'm missing, Chair, that is why I'm saying I'm not sure how to engage with them, because they are a middle person and we're missing information from their side that if the client gives me this amount, I take so much money, I give a security so much money. So that will be a complete information for us to be able to engage with your presentation. The second part, Chair, is that we end up engaging with things that maybe we're not supposed to engage. They are signing a volunteer code of conduct on ethics. What if they don't sign? I'm asking myself. And also, Chair, we're trying to protect them with the, I've been covered about the risks that are attached to this job. But if they are underpaid, if you'll be arguing that the minimum wage will result to job losses, With security involved, we have more robberies to your clients. The heist that we're having now, your security may not be yours directly, but I'm just talking about the sector. It's increasing day by day. They themselves have been protesting now that they're being killed. Don't you think that this underpaid or less salaries they get also contribute to them colluding with the criminals? Because all what I'm saying, you should not only look at the minimum wage, look at other factors that are affecting the industry. Because for me, there is always an inside job in these crimes that are taking place. What are the causes of that? Is it not that they're underpaid? Chair, those are the issues that I have. Or corruption. Yeah, I agree with my colleague that you are more on the rural areas where there is a lot of corruption, which we really condemn. That we really don't agree with it. But when you hear people talking about corruption every day, it's like corruption is a bad thing, I must say. It's not wanted whether private or public sector. But as you present, one realizes how much corruption is there, where companies are robbing direct the security officers. They take money with an aim that they will put it for them to get it later, but they don't. So one is really worried that the extent of corruption, you even rob the people who are getting very little money in terms of compensation or salaries. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Point of default, Chair, I just two issues. Your indulgence, Chair. The issue of equity. By equity, we mean those who have been getting less must now get more. We, as we normalize things in society, Chairperson, point number one, and I'm referring, like my colleague did, to the rural areas where poverty is grinding the worst equity. My second point, Chair, even though I just glance at the documents here. Minimum wage we're saying was 3,500. Now I'm seeing somewhere outer years, according to plan, there is some 4,000 something, Chairperson. Question is, really, in the spirit of humanity, Ubuntu, can't we maybe keep matters, you know, 3.5 up there, and then pick up all these other people, bearing in mind what Honorable Dlamini has just said, that you're not telling us what you're keeping for yourselves. One member this side referred to profit. Can we play open cards here? Because I think all of us, we want best of the best for the people who are working for us, Chairperson. Fairness. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. I'm going to give you 10 minutes, but just to remind members, we are not in negotiations, wage negotiations. We are not putting our positions as yet. We will deliberate, as I indicated, in the third term. That's when then, after that, we will say this is a position of the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development. For now, we hear views from the stakeholders or organizations that are here. We want to caution members that they should not be putting positions now until such time that we have deliberated on the views that have been expressed by all the stakeholders. Yeah. 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, our intention was definitely not to come here and do backdoor wage negotiations. If that came across like that, we apologise. It was never our intention. So I think just in summary, what our intention is what we're basically saying is that the national minimum wage came along and disrupted a very well-established process that we've been going on since 2003, with a very fine balance of deciding where increases would go, where money will be allocated. As we speak, we are, and I think it's in the pack, we are facing a wage demand from the trade unions in excess of 200%. So when we start negotiating, the union started 200%, leaving you as the employer in a very difficult situation. So all we are asking is for the ability to continue with the normal negotiation process that we have in place, be that now under the bargaining council which we've been given, but to allow us to get that fine balance right so that we don't get a shock at one level and you can't fix something else. A three-year period will simply give us the ability to look at this external factor that's now been put in place and that we can't wish away, and that we also agree on the intentions. It'll allow us to focus more on that national, on the minimum wage, rather than focusing on other issues. It just allows us that opportunity, and there's a small matter of still negotiating this with the trade unions, and I can assure you that's not going to be easy. But it just allows us that ability to balance things. It allows the ability not to have a massive shock in the rural areas, where we believe that whilst we agree with you, ma'am, in terms of equity and getting, that must just be done in a fashion that doesn't lead to job loss. And that's the problem. When it, just in terms of the profit margins, yes, companies, and the bigger you get, the more your infrastructure, but then with that infrastructure comes more ability to professionalize your fight against crime. So you start having in place more processes and practices and methods that allows you to give a more professional service. But your ability to get, like in your instance, that contract, these days are almost 100% in the hand of what we call a tender. And in your tender, your client looks at what is the requirements that they have and what are they going to pay. So if you reduce security officers at the expense of that client, you will not get that contract. So we are looked at from that point of view very robustly by most of our clients. So if your profit margin is too big, you will definitely not get that business, because the client will see, but that other provider gives 20 security officers, you give 5, well, you're not going to get that business. So I think our clients are actually the monitoring mechanism there in terms of getting the business. In terms of, I think your question related to, can you just remind me, please, honourable member? Yes. So in terms of the rural constituency, our problem in terms of the exemption that you described is not the exemption by the security company itself. It's the profitability of the client. And that client cannot request for exemption in terms of its provider. So we're not concerned about our own profitability. We're concerned about that low-hanging or that mine that's currently, let's talk Lonmin for a name that jumps into my head. They're already taking strain. They're under business rescue. We do work for a number of these mines that gold fields, these mines that provide work to Eskom, that's recently, I don't want to call names of companies, that had corruption taking place, they're all under business rescue. They will simply just cut the security service because they can't pay for it. So it's not the exemption from us, it's the exemption from the client that can't pay for it. I think there was a question in relation to what happens if members don't sign your code of conduct, well, then they're not members. But we don't purport to be the regulatory authority. There is CIRA that's supposed to check. We are just there to make, from our own point of view, to professionalize the industry, especially where it came from, because we haven't had a good name in the market for a long time, and we're trying to professionalize it. So I just want to see if there's anything else I missed. In the 3 years, it allows us to then balance these things and allow us to get to that point where the focus is more on the minimum wage, and then we can balance it. We've been shaken by this national minimum wage because, in effect, you're talking about before we start the negotiations, and again, I'm not trying to do backdoor negotiations, we are hit with a 20% increase in the rural area. And that happens right in the middle of you negotiating, where you're facing a 200% wage demand, and suddenly there's already a 20% that's come in from the side. It throws out your ability to actually deal with this matter over in a proper manner. Allowances, yes, they are supposed to be inherent of the function, if that is paid. And our problem is, in terms of non-compliance, that is exactly the area where not a lot of these unscrupulous companies are focusing to be non-compliant. So they don't pay the firearm allowance, and they don't pay the allowances that we negotiate at a central level, and they don't provide these people with their provident fund money and the rest. So those are the areas, and the compliance thereof and the policing thereof is very difficult. It's more easy to check compliance in terms of a basic minimum wage. But how do you check compliance if somebody paid a firearm allowance? You don't even know if the guy worked as an armed security officer in that period. And that allows for all those non-compliance things to happen. Our license to operate as a bargaining council and also in this 3 year period will allow us the ability to put in place our own agents, train them up in terms of understanding these intricacies of our industry, and now look at the compliance in terms of firearm allowances and all these allowances that we spoke about. I hope I answered all the questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. No, thank you very much for the responses. And also, let me take this opportunity to thank you for coming and making presentation. We will consider the views that you've expressed when we deliberate as a committee. Thank you very much, sir. Members, there was a request for a 5 minutes break, comfort break. It's 5 minutes, not 10 minutes. But let me also indicate that we're not going to break for lunch. We'll have a working lunch because at 2 o'clock we are having a plenary. So we're not going to break for lunch. When lunch arrives, we just grab lunch and come inside and then continue with the meeting. Just after 5 minutes, then the next presentation will be NUMSA. 5 minutes break. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Flat.
This is your stuff.
Yes.
You guys have membership, or how does it work?
Yes, membership.
Subscription? Or?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So you got paid
yes,
subscriptions?
For subscriptions from various stakeholders, both in government and outside government.
Okay.
And all that. Yeah, so that's how you get paid. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I'll see you on the website.
Absolutely. But of course,
when I look for these things, comes up.
Yes, but of course, they are.
But when I try to get it, like, okay, you're not allowed.
But now, they are open colleges, such as this one, it's open.
It's only for the closed ones.
Yes, there are a few closed ones. Finance, like the high-profile committees, like finance.
So the police one?
Police one is closed as well. Health, I think, is closed.
But then you guys have that?
Yes, of course.
And then you could basically buy it off you? Subscription.
How much is the subscription? I'm not sure what the going rate is for this year, but the subscription runs for an entire year.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, for me, I'm there part-time, so I'm...
They get
students, you know, I'm a student facility, so just come in there for... just for meetings.
No, because I find it interesting. What I want to do is I want to start... I do research.
Oh, okay.
I mean, legal research.
Okay.
In the director's office.
Great, okay.
Like this now, this phone call to say the timing is going to go like this.
Like this.
They're way ahead of the press. By the time it hits the newspaper tomorrow, they know already.
They know already, yeah, absolutely, because the thing is, they're here.
They're coming back in August, they're going to deliberate, they're going to present it.
We're
not going to see this actually the last of course it is.